Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Welcome. This is Through the Smoke on Firehouse.com. I'm Billy Goldfeder, your host. We're going to hit a pretty heavy subject this week. We're going to talk about firefighters burned at training. Firefighters getting injured and even killed, unfortunately, is nothing new in our business, but there's been a recent article and some other recent events that's worthy of discussion amongst all of us and worthy of all of us taking a look at. We've got some outstanding guests with us this morning. We're going to get to that in a few minutes, but first, take a look at some things that are hot right now. We found an article we were reading just recently about a fire near in Volusia County, Florida, where only one firefighter responded to fight the fire. Apparently that firefighter was on the scene by herself for 10 minutes until backup arrived. And while it may not be a shock to many of us to see a fire engine responding with one person, for years we've stated a fire engine with one person on board is a fire apparatus salesman. We're kidding ourselves. When a department's responding one person by themselves, you're probably, in many cases, causing more of a problem than just not even responding. And it's no shock when a fire department responds by themselves or a fire engine responds with one person on board. It's not like, wow, where did that come from? Everyone knew it. If you're a volunteer department and your staffing during the daytime is less than acceptable and one or two people are typically showing up on runs, it's time to fix the problem. Maybe it's a recruitment issue. Maybe it's an issue of hiring some people. Whatever the case may be, when we have a big building with fire trucks inside, the public rides by, they expect service, and they have this false sense of security, not understanding when the tones go off, they may respond with only one person. And it's not just this one department. This happens all over the country. It's time we really start looking hard at the staffing issue. You know, the fire service, we'd run with four people, then we'd get cut, we'd run with two people, and then budget cuts, and then we'd run with one person. We keep saying yes. No matter what the situation is, the fire service will come through, quote-unquote, and don't worry, we'll still respond. At what point does the fire chief, does the commissioner, does the union, does the volunteer association say, you know what, we can't do this without additional help? So it's worthy of thinking, worthy of discussion, one person on a fire engine. That's not the only place in this country that's happened. A couple of highway-related incidents recently. There's been several struck-by incidents. One in particular was in Ellendale, Delaware, just a few weeks ago when a fire police officer, and for those of you that are not familiar with fire police, is basically they're firefighters who handle traffic, and they're certified and qualified to do that and basically have law enforcement powers on the scene of an emergency to direct traffic, divert traffic, handle traffic and crowds, so firefighters working at the scene are better protected. But in Ellendale, Delaware, a fire police officer was directing traffic when he was struck about 5 o'clock in the morning on a highway. The firefighter who was pinned between vehicles was transported with multiple broken legs. He's recovering, but it's a bad situation. Just another reminder of how dangerous it is on roadways and highways, and we can't use people to block traffic. We've got to use apparatus, traffic diversion equipment, cones, barricades. I prefer a multi-ton tower ladder or something big where if they try and run through the fire line area, they're going to hit the truck and not our people. Check out respondersafety.com, www.respondersafety.com, for all sorts of highway safety-related information and, in particular, sample SOPs on how we should be managing traffic on the highways. Keep that in mind. And also, tragically, in the same community in Delaware, in Ellendale, that fire company was responding to an automatic fire alarm at 4:16 in the afternoon. It was an automatic fire alarm. Their apparatus was eastbound approaching an intersection. A civilian in a Chrysler was heading north, and the driver, unfortunately, was struck. According to witnesses, the fire truck had its license sirens on. It blew its air horn as it approached an intersection. The apparatus slowed but did not stop at the stop sign, and they struck the side of the Chrysler, which did not have a stop sign, and that civilian was pronounced dead at the scene. And while our hearts go out to everyone involved, of course the family, but definitely the firefighters, because we've all been in that position, again, another reminder of how we absolutely have to stop at stop signs and stop at red lights. We want to get to the emergency quickly. It sounds like it's a big situation. It's an emergency. In this case, it was an automatic alarm. And in most cases, we know automatic alarms turn out to be nothing. And of course, we have to respond. We got to think. We did no good. No department does any good when they cause an accident. But yet, lives have been changed forever. The apparatus operator, the firefighters on board, and of course, the family of the gentleman that was killed. Please think about responding. You got to stop at stop signs. You got to stop at red lights. You may get away with it a couple times, but eventually your number's going to come up, and the results can be tragic. So please try and learn from what this department is going through right now. And probably the hottest discussion going on right now in our business is the President Bush decreasing grant program money for 07, pretty significant cuts is what he's proposing. He's putting in $293 million for the Fire Act grant program, down from the $545 million appropriated by Congress last year. And additionally, there's no money earmarked for the SAFER program, or SAFER Act, which is the staffing act where departments can actually hire some people on a matching program. And he's also not proposing fire prevention grants. Interestingly, though, last year, the president funded $20 million for the Citizens Corps program, which is CERT teams and fire corps and things like that. And this year, he's proposing a $15 million increase to $35 million. And we're not going to get into the discussions of whether we should be getting this or getting that. Clearly, the Fire Act funding has gone for some very, very important needs, and many departments have done very well in getting equipment that they otherwise may have not received. On the other hand, there are departments who have received equipment that don't need that equipment. There does not seem to be a standard to determine who needs what worse. And there are some departments that have received equipment that they're duplicating, replicating some of the things they have. But yet you look at another part of the country, and even perhaps maybe in another part of that same county, there's a department operating 30-year apparatus because maybe they're just not as good at filling out grants. We think there ought to be more of a standard. It needs to be tightened up. Prove the need a little bit more than just knowing how to fill out a grant. And maybe the folks at FEMA, who we know in the past have had trouble looking at the big picture, maybe they can look at the big picture now and determine really what the needs are. Is this for Homeland Security, or is this to help fire departments buy equipment that they may or may not need? And as far as the SAFER program, while we're major advocates of firefighters being on duty, recruiting more volunteers, and hiring more personnel when needed, we think that program also needs to be looked at. For example, we're familiar with a small borough fire department that within their 1 or 2 square mile borough, there are 5 or 6 other fire companies within a 5 mile range. That little borough fire department received a SAFER grant to hire personnel. Something's wrong with that program. When a small little borough is allowed to hire personnel through federal funding, maybe there ought to be a requirement is if you get money for personnel from the federal government, you must enter into an automatic mutual aid agreement, and when those people are working, they must respond to fires and emergencies in much more than just your little jurisdiction. Maybe that's the way we need to go with the equipment, too. If a community gets a $500,000 grant to buy one of those large communications trucks, maybe any time there's a disaster in their FEMA region, that truck must respond. You know, out in California, the state government provides fire apparatus to different departments, and you can use it for what you need to locally. But when there's an emergency in the state, you must respond with adequate staffing to an emergency anywhere in the state. The Fire Act program, the SAFER program and all, is good and it's positive, and we think it's overall a good thing to go with. However, there needs to be a little bit more tightening down of the rules maybe, and maybe more requirements saying, look, we're going to give you money, we're going to give you people, we're going to give you funding and things like that, but you need to play ball a lot better with others and participate in a much more regional basis so everybody gains from the use of those federal tax dollars. You're listening to Through the Smoke. This is Billy Goldfeder. We'll be back in just a few seconds. We're going to start tackling the issues of firefighters burned during training.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Hey, we're back. This is Through the Smoke on firehouseradio.com. Firefighters burn to training. So much has been talked about over the last couple years as we've witnessed firefighters burn up during training and die from other means during training. And our guests this week on Through the Smoke are three what I would consider noted experts in the area of firefighter safety and training. We've got Chief Dave Daniels, Chairman of the International Association of Fire Chiefs Safety, Health, and Survival Section. Dave is the Fire Chief of Fulton County, Georgia. Welcome, Dave.
Good to be here, sir.
Appreciate your time. We've got Chief Tim Sendelback. Tim is a Division Chief in charge of training for the Savannah, Georgia Fire Department and representing the International Society of Fire Service Instructors as their president. Tim, it's good to have you.
Thank you, Billy. Appreciate the opportunity.
And lastly, but certainly important, as we're going to be focusing on some standards, is Bureau Chief Dave Casey from the Florida State Fire Marshal's office in charge of fire standards and training for the state of Florida. Dave, welcome.
Thank you, Billy. Glad to be here.
We're going to be talking today about firefighters burned to training, but I'm going to start out by an article, reading some parts of an article that is on your website. If you click right here where you click to download the show, if you look below, you see a link to this article. Quoting a fire chief from Marion, Indiana, "If a fireman is on the department and doesn't get burned, he isn't doing his job," the chief said. "If firefighters don't get burned, I don't want them on our department. If they are afraid to get burned, they're on the wrong job." And the article goes on to say, "Two probationary firefighter trainees suffered minor burns Wednesday, during a training." The article describes them as minor burns, but we've since found out that one of them suffered second and third degree burns to their hands during a fire training event in Indiana last week. "It's something we deal with every working fire we have. Somebody will get burned," stated. Firefighter trainees Brandon Eckstein and Ryan Simpkins suffered steam burns caused by the evaporation of a liquid on skin, according to one report. The burns occurred during a training fire at a vacant residence. Steam burns can happen any time. The claims were that neither firefighter's injuries were too serious. But again, as additional information has come in from this situation, the burns turned out to be rather serious. A first-degree burn is something to be concerned with. A second-degree burn and a third-degree burn is cause for alarm when firefighters are going through training. These were firefighter trainees that were very limited in their training and certification levels. Had no time on the job, as a matter of fact. And here we have firefighters again injured during training. Any thoughts before I go on to some additional information? Just some quick shots from each of you on the phone. Dave Casey, thoughts?
Well, just a thought. You know, you look at those incidents and almost all of them, you're going to find a couple common threads. And one of the ones you already hit is most of the time the trainees that are getting hurt have not been sufficiently prepared or trained for what they're being exposed to.
Dave Daniels.
Billy, I see recruit firefighters very, very similar to our kids. And what would we say if our kindergarten kids were going to kindergarten, getting injured, burned, mistreated, what have you? There would be public outrage across the country. Well, what is the difference between new firefighters? They go to recruit school because they don't know what to do. They go there because they aren't trained, because we're trying to show them the rope, so to speak. And to me, for them to be injured and God forbid killed in training is really kind of akin to killing our kids and eating our own. And there really just isn't a good excuse for that. We're supposed to be protecting them, taking care of them, and showing them the way, and showing them the right way to go, not putting them up like sheep for the slaughter. So I think if we would, and we call them kids, Even if they're 45 or 50, we call them kids. So why don't we treat them like that and treat them like we care?
You know, a crotchety old New York City fire captain said to me not very long ago, he says, you know, when we have a probie assigned to the firehouse, that's our child. Mm-hmm. And as much as when we're not going to fires, we may make them do the chores around the firehouse and do the dishes and things like that, when that bell goes off, I have no other responsibility than, one, to take care of my personnel, but even more importantly, to know what that probie is doing at every second, at every moment, and make sure that kid comes home safely. So this is an old guy saying this who gets it, who understands. I mean, it's important enough for us to protect our firefighters, but when you've got an untrained or a very minimally trained trainee, there seems to be nothing more sacred than that. Timmy, you're president of the International Society of Fire Service Instructors, the nation's number one instructor organization. Your thoughts?
Well, I think, Billy, I think it's interesting that Dave took it and mentioned the children. My concern is undoubtedly second, third-degree burns. You said it best. It should raise an alarm. More importantly, looking at this, what is it doing for the future of this profession? We talk about culture with the Life Safety Summit and the Life Safety Initiatives. We are establishing a culture, a continuance of a culture for a whole other generation. When these folks are introduced, these two firefighters, as I understand it, weren't truly firefighters. They're coming into this profession thinking that, hey, this is a normal practice. We are setting up another generation for absolute disaster, so it's certainly alarming.
You know, Tim, that's a good thought. I just, this little idea popped in my head. We're essentially talking about civilians in bunker gear. Unless they've gone through hundreds of hours of recruit basic training, they haven't. You know, welcome to 2006. I'm not sure why this is so hard. Of course, any of us want to train future firefighters in as realistic conditions as possible. And it's best for all concerned, though, that nobody gets burned. After all, burning or getting burned can ruin anybody's day, especially a rookie firefighter trainee's day, his or her career, or their life, not to mention those responsible to train those people. And while as realistic as possible, conditions are important under controlled and highly supervised scenarios, sort of leans into what Dave Daniels was talking about, actually burning a rookie firefighter trainee or any firefighter is out of bounds. Serious burns like that. Well, how bad were they burned? One of the trainees has second and third degree burns to his hands, and the other firefighter trainee has second degree burns to his left arm, shoulders, and to fingers of both hands. This is a problem. You use your hands for everything you do. Your hands are burned. You now are scarred, whether it be mentally, physically, but you'll never forget this. Now, there'll be some out there listening to this show saying, good, they're supposed to remember, they're supposed to learn from this, they'll recover from their burns. What a bullshit old-fashioned idea. In the old days, that's how we did it. Hopefully, we've gotten smarter. And understand, these future firefighters had no more than a dozen hours of any firefighter training each, classroom and practical, and a part of that was basic SCBA. A few hours each, that's it. You know, there's a standard, we'll talk a little bit about some standards in a second here. There's a standard, NFPA 1403, that pretty much makes it clear what we should and not do, or should do and not do, when training firefighters in live scenarios. Now, I looked pretty hard in this document. I can't find anywhere where it says how burned we're allowed to allow firefighters to get. Well trained, yeah, but second and third degree burned, and as Dave Daniels said before, ask yourself, would you want your child, your kid, and as I say, my son or my daughter trained, would you want your son or daughter trained under this type of an attitude? You know, in the last few years, several firefighters have burned to death during trainings. It isn't new in this business, but man, oh man, I thought we were moving forward. And in many, many areas, we are, thanks to people like Dave Casey, Dave Daniels, and Tim Sendelbeck, who are in the forefront in making positive changes in the area of firefighter safety and survival. But then we read about firefighters getting burned during training, and that's just a little sunburn. We'll be discussing this further. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back and dig harder into this to see and discuss other events where firefighters have actually been killed and what changes have occurred since the death of those firefighters during training. You're listening to Through the Smoke on Firehouse.com.
Welcome to the latest edition of Through the Smoke with Deputy Fire Chief Billy Goldfeder, addressing issues impacting all firefighters' safety, health, and morale.
back on Through the Smoke. We're talking about firefighters burned during training. And we've got this week with our guest, as our guest, Chief Dave Casey, who's the Bureau Chief of the Florida State Fire Training College, responsible for standards and training. Chief Dave Daniels, Chairman of the IFC Safety, Health, and Survival Section, and Fire Chief of Fulton County, Georgia. And Chief Tim Sendelback, with the Chief of Training in Savannah, Georgia, and President of ISFSI. We've been chatting about the firefighters who were burned in Indiana, and I want to make mention that I was reading from a newspaper article, and it is my hope that those quotes were inaccurate, that they were taken out of context, and that the reporter totally did not do his job in that article. That's what I'm hoping. Odds are that's not the fact, because we've heard from so many other people who are familiar with the situation.
Really?
Yeah, Dave, go ahead.
You know, interestingly enough, I don't know this fire chief, and again, I hope along with you that those comments were taken out of context, but just for the rest of the fire service who perhaps doesn't feel that way, there are fire chiefs out there who feel that it is my job. The most important thing I do is taking care of my people. In my case, close to 90% of my budget is people. If I treated my trucks the way some fire chiefs treat their people, we'd be in worse shape. And it just to me is unconscionable to think that you want people to come into your fire department and be unsafe. What we've told our people is that's non-negotiable. You're going to be safe, or we have to help you be successful elsewhere, because you're not only going to hurt yourself, you're going to hurt your partner, you're going to hurt the rest of the department, and you're going to hurt my customers. And that's really where that whole discussion about cultural change, it starts in the fire chief's seat. And if the fire chief isn't talking safety, living it, walking it, breathing it, it's not going to happen in the organization. It is not going to happen from the bottom up. As a matter of fact, it's going to make things worse, because people feel like, well, I'm really on the chief's good side because I went out and did something that was not all that smart and got myself injured. So, I'm going to assume that that was a mischaracterization, but there's a lot of fire chiefs out there who don't feel that way, who do feel like the important thing to do is to take care of our folks.
Well said, Dave, and you know, it really is. You're given a firefighter, a human, and said, here from their family, take care of them, and
right.
So often, and each of us at one time or another have forgotten that, and certainly the culture in the last couple of years is changing. We've got to remember, this is somebody's kid, somebody's wife, somebody's daughter, somebody's sister, and you can't get them burnt. My point is, it's not just a couple guys with minor burns. Whether it be this chief or any chief, these folks with authority are going to be crawling all over now, interfering from you doing your day-to-day job. If things had been done right in the beginning, you wouldn't have all these other crises to deal with now, and not to mention some burned firefighters. You know, I got an email. One is from a mother of a firefighter who was burned at another time in a different state. And she writes, articles like this one makes me relive those weeks when my son was injured and the month he spent in the hospital with his burn injuries. He remains scarred today. No family member, no firefighter should ever have to go through what we went through just because someone thinks that they need to get in there, they need to feel what it's like. Yes, firefighters need to get in there during training, and they do need to feel what it's like. Just don't burn them. You know, there's been some firefighter deaths in the past. I am sure that most of you are familiar with Lairdsville, New York. If you Google Lairdsville Fire, Lairdsville, you'll be able to read about the fire where a firefighter was killed and a chief fire officer was charged and actually did time in prison. No fire chief means this to happen. Few fire chiefs. I don't know any fire chief that goes out there and says, I'm going to hurt or burn somebody today, but it happens. Also, another one in Delaware several years ago where a flashover at a controlled burning trapped and killed an assistant chief in Greenwood. Another tragic, tragic, and unnecessary loss of a wonderful, wonderful person. Well, I mentioned standards, and there are standards out there. There's NFPA 1403, which is a live fire training evolutions and structures standard that talks about what you can do, what you can't do. It talks about water supply, equipment, personnel, apparatus, pre-burn briefing sessions, use of fuels that have known controllable burning characteristics, seasoned, trained, and qualified safety officers being on the scene, a working communication center, a usable and workable accountability system, a building evacuation plan, backup safety replacement personnel, EMS on the scene, pre-burn searches, use of full PPE head to toe. And sometimes that doesn't happen. We need to think about our daily fire operations and our training evolutions. So often, we'll go to training with the attitude, it's just training. So why am I going to, I don't need all this extra stuff, but yet on a building fire, we'd send all the right stuff. Hopefully we would. There's a friend who's on the phone with us now, Dave Casey. I've known Dave for years, and it's a pleasure. We've kind of just recently renewed our friendship, just haven't caught up to each other in years. But the state of Florida went through some very, very difficult times in the last several years. Two firefighters were killed in a training burn in Osceola County, and a firefighter died. His death actually was in Broward, but he was a Miami-Dade firefighter. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So I'm going to ask Dave, with Dave Daniels and Tim Sendelbach chiming in when they feel necessary, to talk about, basically, Dave, give us a review of what happened at those fires and share with us as much as you can. And then maybe we'd move on and talk about what Florida is doing now to change and what changes have occurred to prevent firefighter death and injury during training.
Well, we appreciate the opportunity. Our reports are on your website. They have links to it there, and they're pretty extensive. We had two incidents in a very short time frame. The first one was Osceola, where two firefighters died in an acquired structure burn. Now, these were trained firefighters. The lieutenant had been on the job for some time. The other firefighters had not been on very long, but he was a Florida-certified firefighter and had gone through all the recruit required training.
In hours, to be a career firefighter in Florida, how many hour training are you required to have by law?
By law, absolute minimum is 400 hours.
And what about volunteer firefighters in Florida? To be able to be an interior firefighter as a volunteer firefighter in Florida, how many hours are you required to have?
You have to have 160 hours, which is NFPA Firefighter 1 plus NHSTA EMS First Responder.
Okay, so career firefighter, 400 hours, volunteer, a minimum of 160 hours. So in Florida, it is law. You can't fight fire interior without certification.
Correct.
Okay, keep going, Dave.
Well, on the other fire, which was at a marine firefighting training facility at Port Everglades, it was a commercial facility that Miami-Dade Fire was using during that time. That was a different scenario. It was a permanent training prop, and that was a firefighter during the recruit training. It was his very first exposure to fire. So we had two very different scenarios, and while there's some commonality between them, one being acquired, one being a permanent prop, there were different scenarios, and we did detailed investigations on those, both the Bureau of Fire Standards and Training, which in Florida includes the Florida Firefighter Occupational Safety and Health. That was legislation a couple of years back. So we're basically OSHA for the fire service.
Your office is?
Yes.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
I'm not familiar with any other states that is the fire OSHA, where the fire marshal's office or a state fire organization is the fire OSHA. Are you Tim or Dave?
No.
How about Dave Casey? Dave, do any other states have this, or is Florida in the forefront?
We're the only one we know of, and I'm sure other states have bits and pieces, but we actually have all of the normal OSHA legislation assigned to the state fire marshal, and including even infectious diseases and a lot of the EMS issues. But our authority is strictly limited to the fire services.
But you are the, quote, law enforcement agency then, making sure that these standards are followed.
Yes, and the legislation gave us quite a bit of teeth behind that.
Pretty strict. Let me ask you a question. When you did this, and I'm going to let Dave and Tim chime in, I'm not trying to get you off track, but this is of interest. So often we talk about standards and training, people say, well, they'll quit. We'll lose our people. They won't want to work here. Our volunteers will quit. It's too much training. How do you respond to that?
Well, that's been a very big issue in Florida because when FOSHA was adopted, it required for the first time that volunteers have very specific training, and that included the 160. And that was viewed as the death knell of the volunteer fire service. And there was a lot of bad rumors that came out. I mean, that this was a union issue to push volunteers out, and it was anything but. Historically,
how many years did you serve as a volunteer, by the way, Dave?
15.
Yeah, so we have people who are or have been volunteer firefighters involved in this process, so that sort of makes some of that go away.
Yeah, and it did on some of the arguments where we were being told that we had no idea what we were talking about being a volunteer, and that most of the people that said that to me had not been a volunteer as long as I was.
Okay. But
historically, it's real interesting, because if you go back to the late 60s, it was the exact same response that requiring the paid firefighters to have state certification, it was going to be the ruination of the fire service. And, of course, Florida has one of the lower death and injury rates, and we attribute that to the requirement that everybody have that same baseline training. I mean, a lot of the departments have much more training required, but we at least have that baseline. We don't have that theory of years gone by of being on the back step and you just do what Johnny over there does, you know.
Are there any volunteer fire departments that are shut down because of this that you're aware of? Or, I mean, that could be a confusing and unfair question, because there is, in many parts of the country, a transition to hire some personnel to go to combination fire departments due to growth and change. And certainly in Florida, many volunteer fire departments for years were run by folks in their 60s and 70s. They were little retirement community fire departments, some very effective fire departments. But I guess at some point, when you're going to ask someone who's 60 years old to go through fire school, that may have been a problem as well.
And that's an issue right now, and it can even be found in Florida media today. There's articles on it about some things in the Tampa Bay area. But, you know, of retirement areas. But you have to really look at the effectiveness of some of these departments, and you have to look at the danger that they're putting some of the firefighters into by not being trained and not being physically fit. There is no doubt that there are some volunteers that were going on calls 2 years ago that aren't now. But I look back to when I was a county fire chief. I came in, we had 250 volunteers. When I left, we had about a little under 100. But when we had a call, we had a whole lot more people show up when 11 years later than we did when we first started that process and started requiring training.
Right, the numbers game can be played. Sure, yeah, the numbers game, you can, and anyone who listens to the show and knows me knows I'm a big advocate of the fire service volunteer career. I could care less. But, yeah, I'll visit a fire department, they'll tell me they have 150 people on the rolls, and I'll look at the reports for the last year, and the same 25 responded to all the calls. So it's a similar type of a situation.
Well, Dave, I think one of the things you're bringing up, it's really an important public policy question for local government. The first question is, what level of service do you want? And once you decide whether it's paid, volunteer, combination, none of those are bad decisions. But once you decide you want a level of service, part of deciding you want a level of service is, what quality of people do I want to do it? Or do I just want to throw some folks out there and see if we get lucky? And see, part of that minimalist attitude, I think, has contributed to our culture, because, and Billy talked about it earlier, we've made it work for so long with about nothing, and now there's this expectation for us to continue it, and we're sacrificing each other to do it. We're sacrificing each other physically, mentally. We're putting folks out there who probably shouldn't be doing it, but their heart is to do it. But, you know, the good book says that, you know, spirit's willing, but the flesh is weak. And a lot of cases, we have a lot of really good people, but they've just worn out. And we continue to accept nothing, and then we go out and make it work. To me, it's about deciding that we want a level of service, and you need a certain level of quality of person. And that's not a, you know, social comment at all.
Right.
But you need people who are qualified to do certain things to do this work.
And the local governments have to be willing to pay for it.
That's right. That's
whether
right.
You're paying salaries, or a volunteer fire department still costs money. They
That's
need
right.
good equipment.
It's not free.
Yeah, we want a great level of service in our community, but we're going to continue voting down the tax levy. Well, screw you.
Right.
I mean, there's only so much we can do with this much.
Right.
Tim, let me jump over to you for a second. Where else in this country, and then we're going to jump back to Dave Casey so he can tell us about the two specific fires and what happened, so we can learn where they've been, so we can see where they're going and where they are now, because there's a state law that just passed in Florida of interest. But, Tim, are you aware of anywhere else in the country where the standards are equal to what they're doing in Florida, as stringent, moving that way, Because I think if you've been involved in the fire service for any period of time, any of us know Florida's got that, quote, certification program, and it's law. Where else out there, Tim, is that going on?
You know, I wish I could say that I know definitively specific areas that have that. I know Georgia has just recently changed and is now offering a certification process for volunteers where it wasn't before. And I think more and more people are starting to focus on that. And with the attention such as this program is going to put on the issue, I think the fire service is going to start leaning that way. Just to kind of go back to the comment that Dave had made, or Chief Daniels had made, you know, when we talk about what the investment is going to be and what the city forefathers are expecting as far as service, at the same time, organizationally, the firefighters within that organization have to basically make a stance. We're not going to make do with a few. We're not going to cut these corners and jeopardize our safety. I mean, we have to introduce that as well. And I think that's been ultimately a huge, huge shortcoming in our training, that we only do what we're physically capable of doing in a safe and proficient manner. And we don't cross that line when the mission is no longer life safety, it's now just property preservation. We've got to take a stance, and I think we've missed that along the way.
What are we dying for? I mean, that ties right into it. One fire we're familiar with that happened in Canada last year, where two firefighters were killed in the line of duty for a saw shed that was on fire on the side of a home furnishings business. They died for sawdust. And, what's the risk versus benefit? Back to Dave Casey. Dave, you had three firefighters killed. These seem to be the focus of where you guys have been. Can you share with us what happened in Osceola County and what specifically happened in Broward to the Miami-Dade firefighter?
Well, again, there are two different scenarios, and the fire in Osceola followed a series of burns. They were burning down an old neighborhood, actually, that for redevelopment. And they weren't really that old buildings. It was just, again, it was redevelopment going on. And there they had a couple specific problems. They had very experienced people doing the training. It wasn't your inexperienced training officer doing a new burn. But they had some mistakes, and if the folks look at our reports, there's some photographs in there that they had a very serious choke point that personnel had to go through, and the fire load was tremendously too high for the room they were in. And when things went south on them, the two firefighters that died were not able to get in, even though the troops on scene, as soon as it was realized that they were missing two, made very strong attempts. I mean, you can look at the damage to the gear of the teams that were trying to do the rescues. Their gear was destroyed trying to make the rescues. So that one was a particular case of too much fuel load for the area they had and a lack of ventilation. And another thing that we've identified looking at a lot of the NIOSH reports, not necessarily Florida ones, but it was present in this, that they really didn't have those escape routes in place, that their primary vent point was the primary means of egress. And of course,
it's interesting that you know, we send these same firefighters go out and do inspections of buildings to make sure that there's proper exits for the public, but yet how do we treat ourselves? That's sort of what popped in my head just now as you described that. And when you said choke points, what you're talking about is how they're getting out or how they're getting in?
Right. There was a hallway in there that was an incredible choke point. I'm trying to leaf through here, find the actual dimension. But, with you full-grown with gear on, trying to get through that narrow space, it was very difficult. It was 26 inches wide.
Wow. Okay. All right.
So you can imagine trying to go through there with a bottle on your back and drag a hose line through there.
So what actually happened? What was the event, Dave?
The event there is they were in a converted garage. They had a foam mattress, a couple pallets, some hay. They had had way too much of a fuel load for the room. Once the fire got going, it rolled over on them. The two firefighters were not able to make it either to the that narrow exit or through a window that a firefighter on the exterior opened up. And it was a big window that they were going to try to get them out through that way. And they just weren't able to do it. I mean, the fire came out in such a heavy volume. I mean, it was literally floor to ceiling coming through the doorway, and the entire window was fully engulfed.
So basically, too much fuel, too much fire in a small area with two firefighters stuck inside.
Yep, and without the ability to really get a line in there. And that's one of the things that we've identified in the new law that's beyond what 1403 requires, that you need to have a hose line in position that can do something all the time and monitor the fire conditions. And, you know, if things start going bad, that you can cut it off before we go to something like this.
Okay. We're going to come back in a minute. Dave, you've done a great job in helping us understand what happened in Osceola County. We're going to come back and ask you to tell us about the totally separate type of event, but yet led to the death of a firefighter from Miami-Dade Fire Department, or Fire Rescue. That happened at a training facility in Port Everglades in Broward County. Those of you listening, some of you may agree with this, some of you may not. You may think this is all a bunch of BS. Some people, and the attitude mine many, many years ago was, if you're not burned, you're not doing your job. But we've woken up, we've matured, we've gotten smarter, and we need to realize that burns suck. And odds are, if you feel that way, you've probably never been seriously burned. You need to spend time with firefighters who have been burned, or better yet, read these reports right here on the website. You'll be able to click links, and you'll download all the reports we're talking about here. We're going to be back with Chief Dave Daniels, Chief Tim Sindelback, and Chief Dave Casey. We're going to talk about the new law in Florida. We're going to come back and talk about specifically what happened at that other incident. And then we're going to give Dave Daniels and Tim Sindelback time to talk about the IASC and the ISFSI, what they're doing in helping stop firefighter injury and death during training. We'll be right back.
Is it sometimes a little hard to see through the smoke? Do fire service, rescue, and EMS issues work you up just a bit? Maybe more than just a bit? If they don't, check your pulse. It's normal for firefighters and responders to get worked up over hot issues when you love the job so much. Deputy Fire Chief Billy Goldfeder, Firehouse.com commentator and Firehouse Magazine columnist, hosts Through the Smoke, an internet broadcast and podcast that addresses issues impacting all firefighters, such as safety, health, and morale. Don't ignore the issues and maintain the status quo. Take an interest in issues that impact you, the frontline responder. Join Billy, special guests, and firefighters around the country and the world regularly on Through the Smoke, only on Firehouse.com.
We're back, Through the Smoke, radio at Firehouse.com. We're talking to three outstanding firefighters, fire chiefs who are focused on firefighter survival, and particularly today we're talking about firefighter training and the deaths and injuries that have occurred to firefighters during firefighter training. Make sure you please do check out the links we've provided for you here, in particular NIOSH, the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, has a great download on there called Preventing Deaths and Injuries to Firefighters During Live Fire Training and Acquired Structures. If you take that, use it as a guide, nobody will die at your training. Nobody will burn up. Nobody will get severely injured. The standards are there. Some of these standards are nothing new. You know, during the break, we were chatting amongst ourselves, and Chief Sindelback brought up a good point. He says, how is training being conducted? And so we would ask that question to Tim to talk to the audience. What do you mean by that? How is training being conducted? You talk about people, equipment, tools, what?
I think it's all of the above. I know as a chief of training here in Savannah, it's one of those things where we're training recruits. Number one, there's a certain fashion that we train recruits. We've got to set the appropriate culture for those recruits. We want to burn in a certain manner that, number one, we're not scaring the recruits. We are creating a degree of respect for what they're going into. But at the same time, looking at the resources that we apply to that training, a live burn is literally a structure fire. And what we need to do is start directing our attention and applying the exact same resources that we would for a structure fire. And I've seen it all across the country. We start make and do. Well, we couldn't get this. We couldn't get this specific resource. Couldn't get an ambulance to stand by. And what we do is we shave the corners. And ultimately, I think we see the results in some of the case studies that we're talking about, we have got to allocate the appropriate resources and make sure the appropriate level of expertise is on site to conduct these burns.
You know, what's an interesting point, Timmy, is if you say to some fire departments you've got to have the same exact resources you would at a working fire, you may get six people. So it really has to almost be beyond that. That's a whole other radio show, is six people going responding in a first alarm on a structure fire. But it needs to almost be beyond what you were just pointing out. And your points were outstanding that, you know, if you're going to have three staff lines at a single-family dwelling, a staff truck company, rehab, EMS, sector commanders, then you need to have that at the training burn. But some fire departments, as I mentioned earlier in the beginning of the show, are going in so woefully and inadequately staffed that we're kidding ourselves. So we're doing it at training as well, is basically what you're saying.
Absolutely. I'll take that a little bit further. We've got to look at this. I mean, this is a big deal for us, and it needs to be a big deal regardless of the size of the department that we have. But what we're looking at is we're going into these buildings in a rotational process typically. A recruit or any firefighter conducting a burn is going in there repeatedly. We've got to look at the fatigue factor, what their conditions are going to be on that second, third, or fourth burn. And we do. We got to blow it into a big deal event and make sure the adequate resources are there. And your point is taken in the fact that sometimes departments are out there going with six, seven people, and obviously that's not adequate to conduct a live burn.
But okay. Billy, another point.
Go ahead, Dave Daniels. Go ahead.
On the whole staffing issue, staffing is a two-sided question. On the one side, it's about the resources that are available to us in our jurisdiction, good, bad, or indifferent. Sometimes we have, you know, a lot. Sometimes we have a little. But probably even more important than that is the decisions that we make based on what we have. So, again, I don't have a problem with a department that has two people who show up. The problem is when those two people try to do the work of 15.
All right, we can only do two people's worth of firefighting.
Exactly right.
Yes.
So if the two people showing up can only do safely X, that's all we should be doing. We shouldn't be doing any more than that until we get the resource. So, and then the argument is, well, stuff will burn down and the customers will be excited. Well, maybe they need to be. Maybe that's a part of the problem, and it goes back to, I think, Tim, maybe you were saying it earlier, we have made it work with too little for so long that it's become normal. And so we take that same mentality into training. Well, you know, we go to fires every day, and we put three or four people out there, and the fires always go out. The reality is that all emergencies will terminate themselves eventually, with or without our intervention. The question is whether or not we're going to get hurt doing it. So we just got to change that mindset. What you got's what you got, but you can't make it something that it's not. If you only got two people, you do two people work, not 10. If you have 15, you do more. If you got 30, you do more, but it is what it is, and we just got to be realistic about the resources we have available to us.
Yeah, the staffing issue is one, obviously, that's near and dear to my heart, and we'll talk to departments who complain about staffing, but yet they have crap relationship with their neighbors, so they don't call them for mutual
Absolutely.
Aid. There's a lot of solutions.
That's
it's
right.
Sometimes hiring people, sometimes it's recruitment issues, sometimes in volunteer departments it's the BS in the firehouse, why your people don't come around. But if you want staffing and you want enough people responding, there are solutions. Let's get back to Chief Dave Casey. Dave, we appreciate your insight on the tragic loss of the two firefighters in Osceola County, and their loss has created change. And as tragic as their loss was, if we have to lose people, if we can learn from that and we can affect change, then their loss lives on forever, and it brings more meaning to who they were and to what happened. And you've certainly done that in Florida. What about the second incident you were talking about that happened down at the training facility? It's a facility, Dave, is that right?
Correct. It's a facility at Port Everglades. Resolve is the name, and they're specifically there for Marine firefighter training. Training the folks on the cruise ships, the freighters, everything else. And this program was being run through another fire department that was a certified training center. Miami-Dade at this point is not a certified training center. They don't have the facilities themselves, although they are working toward that goal, and in fact just announced that the new facility will be named after Wayne Mitchell, who was the firefighter that died at Resolve.
And Dave, can we, out of respect also, would you mention the names of the firefighters that lost their lives in Osceola County too, so we can respect them also?
Sure. You have Lieutenant McHale and Dallas Baggs, and you know, their department's really gone through a lot with that. I've got the challenge coin the fire department did following that right here in my desk, and
so we never forget.
No, so we won't forget. It's got the badge numbers on and such on there, and it was a good memorial.
Anyway, back to the Dade situation. What actually happened there, Dave?
There, they had a prop that was not for recruit firefighter training. I mean, it could be used in a scaled down version, but we had a fire that was off grade. They had to go through stairs to get up to it, then stairs to make entry. Five watertight marine kind of doors. Had to go down a marine set of stairs, which of course are very steep. There were multiple fires in the prop. They had a large, like a hearth type, where you could do Class A's, but there was also gas props in there, and at least one of which had been operating. The recruits were exposed to a situation where they were told before they went in that if they didn't do well, if they had a problem, just leave their gear at the outside gate and walk out because they were fired.
They were told this?
Yes.
Okay.
And that was confirmed. It's in our report, in fact, and it's been confirmed. Now, there is a lawsuit that we're not named in underway now against the facility and against the training center. But the individuals were under a very high heat situation. They were told they couldn't grab the rails on the marine ladder because they would get burned. They couldn't crawl across the grating to get toward the fire room, to the stairs down to the fire room, because, again, they would be burned. And the crew that went in, the decedent was on, very high heat. They each took a turn on the nozzle. The instructors that were in the fire area actually left at a grade level door to the exterior.
Dave, maybe I missed it. How is this fire being fed?
This at this point was pallets. It was
okay,
a Class
A fire.
Okay,
so this was not gas. This was burn. This was pallets burning.
Correct.
Okay, go ahead.
And there was an instructor inside that attempted to lead the students out. The scene got separated from that group. As soon as they did exit, it was determined. And by the way, they didn't leave on grade exit. They had to go up the stairs, across the grating, and out five marine grade doors to get to a landing, and then go down another set of stairs to get outside.
Okay.
And actually, excuse me, that landing was outside, but to get back to grade, they'd have to go down those stairs. And it was immediately noticed that Mitchell was missing. They re-entered. It's believed at that point Mitchell was still mobile because they searched areas, did not find him, and then found him in an area that they had searched. And it was a matter that the initial exposure to a fire, that's one of the things that we stress so much in the administrative rules, needs to be a very controlled situation that you're going to see how the people react to it. And this was a very aggressive situation, high heat, large area, a lot of different things to work through with the different doorways, stairs, gratings, you know, a lot of situations to go through for a first-time burn.
Okay. Unbelievable. So he was found. Is that where this went?
He was found. He was brought right outside. When he was found, he was
so
pulseless.
Do I understand he was unaccounted for a period of time?
Yeah, for a short time.
Okay, I mean, so they came out.
Right, when they brought the people out, they were following the hose line, and there was at that point only one instructor, and he was actually more of a backup position to monitor, you know, the situation.
So there was a supervisory issue.
Yes.
Meaning not enough instructors to supervise the trainees.
Well, there were not enough with them. And,
okay.
You know, there's that situation, and again, this is covered in our report. We're not talking out of house here.
No, absolutely.
That the students were sent in individually. This is their first burn again. They were
right.
Sent in one at a time, follow the hose line, go through those five watertight doors, go down the stairs, and then go into the burn room, and then reassemble there where they did the suppression training.
Okay, so they came out.
And, you know, so that was really a very difficult scenario for an initial exposure.
I'd say that's a difficult scenario for a seasoned firefighter. through the watertight doors and that whole situation, sure.
You know, if you're talking at trained firefighters and you're going through Marine training, that's probably not an unrealistic scenario. It's actually, unfortunately, real realistic for that area of Florida where you have a lot of
shipboard
firefighting.
Sure, right.
But for an initial exposure, we felt that was very inappropriate.
Okay. And they came out, realized this firefighter was missing?
And they immediately re-entered. And
who re-entered?
Instructors. They had instructors re-enter.
Okay, so they were their own RIT team, so to speak.
Right. Now, the two that came out were heat saturated, and they did not make an immediate re-entry, but other instructors did, including the one that was bringing the crew out.
Okay.
You know, if you look at the other members of that team that went in for training, there were other injuries, and one did lose consciousness outside.
Okay.
And
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, and it was not an isolated, just Mitchell had a problem. The other people that were involved had a great deal of heat exposure, did have burn injuries, and again, the one did lose consciousness.
Okay, so they went in, they found the firefighter. How long did that search take?
By all the timelines we can indicate that we can tell, it was
ballpark. Sure.
Yeah, it was not a real long time. I mean, and I'd have to paw through the report real quick.
That's
for that.
Okay. The listeners can do that. We're talking a minute or two, a couple minutes.
It was not an extensive time.
Okay, they removed the firefighter, and the firefighter's condition upon removal.
He was unconscious. He was not breathing. He was very cyanotic. He had significant burn injuries to his hands and to his knees.
Okay.
And there was not EMS on site. There was trained paramedics and there was some equipment on site. Broward County Fire had a station adjacent to the facility.
Right.
In fact, the first notice was one of their employees was out back, saw them bringing Mitchell out, and then he raised the alarm. Their ALS transport was not in quarters, but it was in the port, so it got to the facility quite quickly, and they had initiated care with the personnel on scene from Dade and then from the troops from the Broward station, and he was transported to a trauma center, which is very close by.
Okay. So three firefighters lost their lives in the line of duty during training. That absolutely motivated the Florida Fire Service and your office in particular to effect change. We'll be back in just a minute with Dave, who's going to share with us what changes have occurred, what the new laws are in Florida, and what other states may be looking at these same laws to ensure nobody gets hurt or killed during training. You're listening to Firehouse Radio Through the Smoke. We'll be right back.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
We're back on Through the Smoke, Firehouse Radio, radio at firehouse.com. We're talking about firefighters who've lost their lives or been seriously injured during training. And we're going to kick it right back into Dave Casey's corner. Dave very eloquently and professionally described the tragic loss of firefighter Dallas Begg, Lieutenant John McKell, and firefighter Wayne Mitchell in two separate events. So what's changed now? What's new? What is Florida doing? You got a wake-up call, a horrible wake-up call. What changes have occurred?
And you're right. It was just an awful, awful situation to have. And Florida legislature saw fit to adopt the McKell-Begg's law. And what that adopted is NFPA, parts of NFPA 1402, most of 1403, a lot of administrative rules that were in addition to 1403 requirements. And we mentioned a couple of things, additional requirements as far as better monitoring, ventilation, communications, a lot of things that came through the people that we worked with, which included the League of Cities, Association of Counties, the Florida Professional Firefighters, the Florida Fire Chiefs, the Florida Fire Training Directors. So it's an inclusive act. It wasn't just something that came down as a regulation that so many safety agencies get in trouble for. I mean, this was an inclusive process. What's really important out of the rule, besides just those standards that were adopted, it requires instructors to be credentialed. It's a 40-hour training program on live fire, not just the rules, not just the book learning, but how do we run these things safely? And it also requires that not only the incident commander or the instructor in charge and the safety officer have that 40-hour certification, but the other instructors that are in there leading crews in and taking primary positions at these live fire, not just recruit, but also in service, they have what's called the live fire adjunct instructor training, which is only 16 hours. We've made the program. We've already done the internal review. We're doing an external review this month. And the certified training centers in Florida, which there's 31 of, will all be able to give this course so that the local fire departments have that access locally and can gain that training very easily. So it's not just a set of rules. It's training. It's giving the people the tools to do what needs to be done.
What prerequisites must you have before you can take this course to conduct training?
Well, there's a couple levels. The folks that are doing the trainers are required to be certified instructors in Florida, which requires 6 years of experience, completion of certain coursework, and an actual state certification as an instructor before they even take this instructor course. For the live fire adjunct, the requirements are much less because we want the company officers that are out there doing the training or have been doing the training with the troops to get that additional training to, again, give them some more tools in that toolbox to be better prepared. So the adjunct trainer is not required to have nearly as much training and experience. But again, those are the folks that are out there doing the training, and we want to make sure they're prepared.
Who fought you on this?
Well, that's kind of an interesting point.
Only reason I ask questions.
We really weren't. The training task force that put the rules, the administrative rules together, had everything from rural volunteer fire departments to metropolitan fire departments like Palm Beach County. Palm Beach was one of the biggest people involved in this, so is the Central Florida Fire Academy, and which covers the Orlando area. And so
right.
We had that very broad cross-section. We had to take it through our Standards Council, which is a legal body, and on that is, like we said, the League of Cities, Association of Counties, Special Districts, the Union, the Fire Chiefs, and citizens. So it really covered that spectrum. So when it came to crunch time, here's the rules, here's the law, everybody had their say. So we really didn't get fought on this.
Outstanding. It's good to see when different factions, if you will, of the fire service come together, realizing something needs to be changed.
Well, like you said, it was a terrible wake-up call. And I think the connections between those entities that frequently aren't at the table or had not been at the table together, I think we're going to try to keep everybody at the table and keep moving ahead.
Well, it makes sense. The common goal is that any of the people at this table are representing people that could have burned up, could have died during a training event, and all of them understand that they're representing their constituents, so those folks can come home safely and don't go through this again. I mean, it's bad enough in our business when we suffer a tragedy. What's worse sometimes is when we don't learn from it. We just keep going. And most recently, as we saw what happened in Indiana, these firefighters getting burned, certainly they didn't lose their lives, thank God, and whatever luck might have been with them that day, but they could have, and it could have been more tragic. And Florida's efforts are setting a tone, setting an example. I can't imagine that the folks in charge in Indiana are not going to be looking to see what Florida has, to see what changes may need to be made there, because they got a wake-up call without the loss of life, and they got a bonus, if you will. Nobody died. Dave, any final comments from you? Because I want to go to Tim and Dave Daniels to find out what the ISFSI and the ISC are doing and going with issues in the area or going with their energies in the area of firefighter safety, particularly in the area of training. Dave,
is that we're working with the NFPA 1403 committee on this. We've been out to the meeting at Las Vegas, and we're working hand-in-hand with them. And our finished product is almost there. We're going to present it to the North American Fire Training Directors at FDIC and make it, readily available to the other states. And we'll be putting it out through trade also. So it'll be available. This isn't just a Florida issue. We want to make sure it's available to whoever wants it and whoever needs it.
You know, another state that learned to some extent was New York State. Bradley's Law. I mentioned earlier the firefighter killed in Lairdsville, New York, Bradley Golden. Bradley's Law was obviously named after Bradley, and it did affect some positive change in live burn exercises for fire departments. Dave, outstanding description, and thanks for sharing what Florida's doing. Tim Sendelbeck, president of ISFSI. Where's ISFSI on this? Anything going on now currently as far as what you're doing on behalf of firefighters and instructors to minimize injury and to eliminate firefighter death during training?
Well, thanks, Billy. And before I say that, I'd just like to commend the state of Florida for what they're doing. I think it's absolutely outstanding. The fact that we're putting reports out there is another great learning tool, admitting to where we've had some faults to create corrective action across the fire services of the utmost importance. And I'm proud to say that the state of Georgia is also implementing a structural fire control instructor for live burn training as well. In regards to the ISFSI, it's just so ironic that we're talking about this subject today. On the basis of a previous instructor fatality, the ISFSI just recently, we started a task group of best practices for 1403 burns. It's one of the things that we wanted to collectively put together some material and free of charge basically create a distribution route for instructors to safely and effectively conduct live fire burns. So we're basically putting together a work group that is doing some research on it, and hopefully we'll eventually put out a product free of charge to instructors to conduct those live burns.
Outstanding. That's, you know, I always ask an organization or a section or a committee, what are you delivering? What's your final product? And you're delivering a product, something that can be used, and that's going to make a big difference. Who's funding that?
Well, it's very much the research stage. That's what we're going to be seeking out, is how are we going to pull this off? How are we going to get it out to the masses?
Sounds like it would be good money to be used by a Fire Act grant.
I think you're 100% on track.
Yeah, good. Chief Dave Daniels, president of the newly organized IAFC Safety, Health, and Survival Section. Very busy this year as that new section has been born. Anything in particular, Dave, or any thoughts from you in regard to these discussions, and perhaps maybe you'd like to bring the section in this area?
Well, Billy, I my thoughts, you know, as to where the section is going connected to this are really the same as they are with our other issues. I believe our section is kind of a force multiplier that we have, and you did mention it, but as our vice chair, everything that you do is a reflection of our section. So even having this conversation today is something that, you know, the section can't take total credit for, because we're not looking for credit, we're looking for results. And then Tim being on our executive board helps us as well, because the activities that go on in IFSI, that they all kind of help us do what we're trying to do. We're trying to not necessarily do lots of things, but cause lots of things to happen. So we're engaged in a number of different activities, one of which is coming up here real soon. We're having some conversation with NIOSH. They have a meeting coming up in Washington, D.C., where they're asking folks from across the fire service to come and share with them how they can not only continue but improve the firefighter investigation process and some of the other things that NIOSH is doing. And we're representing the section at that meeting, and a couple other meetings are out there. Another thing that we're doing, and again, you and I, Billy, are spending some time doing that, is the new National Firefighter Near Miss Program. Firefighternearmiss.com is providing some data. We just had our 500th report, and that's providing some data, and we're looking to connect that data with the research agenda that the fire service is trying to get started down at Oklahoma State University and Maryland Fire and Rescue as well, connecting these two groups to try to take that data and turn it into information that fire chiefs can use. So the section, we are involved and engaged in so many different areas, it would probably take another hour's conversation we probably don't have. But I'm proud to say that the International Association of Fire Chiefs and fire chiefs across this country are starting to take the leadership role that they should take. Notwithstanding, there's a couple out there who don't quite get it yet, and that's okay. We'll bring them along. But I hear more and more often fire chiefs realizing their responsibility and the critical nature of us taking care of our people, because we brought them to work, and we ought to be responsible for making sure that they get back home.
It's hard to argue with that kind of logic. At the bottom of your webpage there, gang, you see a link to the Firefighter Near Miss Reporting System. Click it, check it out, amongst the other links that are appearing there today. You know, another organization that we have not mentioned specifically that I feel very strongly has been for years, well before it became, quote, the thing to do, focused on firefighter safety and survival, and that's the IFF. The International Association of Firefighters, of course, which is the AFL-CIO affiliate, is focused on their membership, but volunteer firefighters and chiefs and others have to remember many of the motivations by the IFF in firefighter health and safety have positively impacted all firefighters, irregardless of your affiliation or your belonging or not. And I continually commend the IFF. You may like him, you may not, it doesn't matter to me. The fact of the matter is that they take care of their members, and now we're seeing the IFC focused on health and safety, ISFSI, National Volunteer Fire Council, all following that lead that's been around for years. As we wrap this up, I want to recognize and honor the memories of firefighter Dallas Begg, Lieutenant John McKell, and firefighter Wayne Mitchell. Dallas and John from Osceola County Fire Rescue, and Wayne from Miami-Dade Fire Rescue, who tragically lost their lives, and we've been discussing how they lost their lives today, and the tragic circumstances, but how the state of Florida Fire Service has learned from that. We recognize and honor the memory of New York firefighter from Lairdsville, New York, Bradley Golden, and the tragic loss, of course, of Delaware Assistant Chief Greenwood, Delaware, Arnold Blankenship. And the loss of those five individuals have created a situation for us to talk today. Final thoughts, Chief Dave Daniels.
Well, I'd like to thank you, Billy, for what you're doing, for taking the time out to have these conversations on a regular basis, because the fire service is going to get better the more we communicate. And our issue in most cases is not our people. It's the systems we put people in. And a lot of times we don't provide adequate resources for these systems to function properly. And this conversation about training hopefully is going to get some folks' attention, and they're going to think twice about the next time they go out and half train, because if you half train, you'll half perform. And again, I can't say thanks enough for the opportunity to hang out with you, and I'm sure we'll be talking more in the future.
Appreciate that, Dave. Chief Tim Sendelbach, final thoughts.
Billy, I'd like to also express my appreciation. It's an honor to be on the program and talking about such a critical subject. I would like to kind of conclude my statement with an industry challenge in the fact that each of these incidents is about making the fire a little bit hotter, a little bit better, theoretically, for the folks involved. And that's one of the biggest challenges in the training arena we face, is making the training realistic, safe, and effective. And we've got to find a better way to train our firefighters and to ensure that each and every one of them goes home after the event. To accept injuries as part of training is absolutely the wrong approach. We've got to find a way to prevent them and take a proactive approach with that. So I appreciate the opportunity.
That's a pleasure. And Chief Dave Casey, a special thanks to you, Dave, for allowing us to focus hard on what you've been doing in Florida. Some final thoughts, Dave.
Actually, he just covered my final thoughts pretty conclusively there. That's just, you know, groups like the ISFSI, the IFC, the IFF, and we've got the NFPA and NAFTD out there. If we can try to focus, everybody's got their attention, and I think we're all going in the same direction, but we really need to try to do it a little bit more together.
That thanks so much, Dave. That ties into so much of what we talked about, and even with, like, the Fire Act grants. The next couple of weeks is going to be the debates, and we need this money for this, and we need this money for that. And as someone said to me the other day, and I won't mention his name because I don't have permission to do that, the comment was, when they ask us what we've done with the money and how services have improved, what are we going to tell them? I don't know that there's a document out there that can say, okay, they provided this much money for the Fire Act Grant Program, this much for that, and this is what we've gotten. my point is we don't speak in one voice, and we can't always speak in one voice. There's clearly differences in our different organizations. But just as you guys mentioned, speaking in one voice for firefighter safety and training in particular, we need to work better in speaking in one voice most of the time, especially when we're talking to people inside the Beltway. Well, you've listened to Radio at Firehouse.com today, the show's Through the Smoke, and you may think this is all a bunch of BS. You may think you got to get burned, you got to get toasted, you're not doing a job if you don't get hurt. And I don't know what to tell you. Then go ahead and get hurt and burned and see how it feels, and then maybe you'll agree or disagree. The folks we know who have been burned, true firefighters who've been injured, understand that ain't the way to operate. Certainly doing the job when there's a life to be saved, when the risk is worth the benefit. If we get hurt, if we get injured, we accept that to some extent because we're attempting to save someone's life. That's the true risk of the job. But there's so many times where we take risk where it's absolutely necessary. We wish a quick recovery to the Indiana firefighter trainees, trainee Eckstein and trainee Simpkins, and we wish deep thought to those who are involved in these situations to think about what's happened to firefighters or trainees such as Eckstein, Simpkins, and hundreds of others who get injured or burned every year, that you're responsible for these kids. I don't care, like Dave Daniels said, they could be 50 years old and they're still kids. You're responsible for these folks to get them home safely. You got to look yourself in the mirror just like I do and any other chief does. Are we doing what's best to take care of these people while, as Dave Casey and Tim Sendelbeck said, get them the best training possible? If staffing is an issue, and we always seem to touch on that one, figure it out. If you're volunteers and you don't like career firefighters, get over it. If you're a career firefighter and don't like volunteers, same answer. You need to work it out if that's where your nearest help is. If they're not as well trained, get them trained. Have them participate. Where's that, quote, brotherhood we talk about, the sisterhood? Put it to action. And, you know, if your nearest engine company is far, far away, you better start working with your neighbors. This is not about you. It's about the folks we protect and the responsibility we have to get our people sent home safely after everyone, and that comes to training. Professional, well-learned, well-taught, by qualified instructors training without anybody getting hurt or killed. Thanks for listening. We're knocking it off right now. We'll talk to you soon. This is Billy Goldfeder, your host at Through the Smoke, Radio at Firehouse.com. Be careful.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.